And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from a preposterously cold Toronto, Ontario, Canada, where the Maple Leafs are out. My Boston Bruins. I only know two guys on the whole team. I haven't watched a hockey game in 15 years, but they're still my Boston Bruins. Have eliminated the Maple Leafs. But that is not what we are here to talk about. Kevin Arnovitz, you and I attended Raptors Magic last night. One of three laughers out of four NBA games. I went home and I watched laugher number three, Nuggets Spurs. And I was about to go to bed. And I checked Blazers Thunder. I said, you know what? I can't go to bed. I saw people tweeting about Dame. I flipped on my laptop. Dame hits a three to put them up 84-75. I think, well, that's it. Thunder are going to let go of the rope. Now it's over. I'll tune in. And then I saw a lot of stuff happened. How are you feeling this morning about this game? What did you stayed up? Both of us are old men.
We are. We would not
normally stay up, but we stayed up.
I walked in the hotel room. It was halftime. 35 points in first half is just tantalizing enough for me not to conk out in the first 15 minutes of a late game. And this is weird for me because I'm on the West Coast. So I live in a world where basketball is at 4 o'clock and 6:30 or 5 and 7:30. It's wonderful.
Sounds great.
But this is – so when I get shipped east, this is always the dilemma. It's like I cease to be a Western Conference person. And it's so interesting. I mean, you've made a career out of kind of – as many of us have, like, analyzing probabilities and sort of identifying good shots from bad shots. And there are certain glorious moments when you get to suspend all of that and watch this. And it's been such a tantalizing series for so many reasons, right? I mean, the back and forths. These are two guards, one in this prime, one in his late prime.
Might be being generous there, but
okay, yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit because I kind of want to figure out where we are with Russ and this illustrious career, Dame has grown so much as a pick and roll player. He's always had a certain command and charisma. I've always loved his stage presence. I mean, stage presence to me is sort of kind of where I define Dame, and then. It just went. And I actually thought when they went up 9, I was ready to turn in. And then when they coughed up that run to Oklahoma City, I was also ready to turn in. And I kind of just stayed with it.
Well, we got rewarded. We got rewarded with like an absolutely – I mean, this guy has two walk-off playoff series game-winning shots in his career. We may never see a guy do that again ever in our lives.
I was trying to think of one series walk-offer.
I don't even, yeah, there may not, look, I haven't looked at all the stats that have surely been tweeted out and this and that. It was late at night and now it's early in the morning. Maybe this is already out. I bet it's never happened before. It's crazy. And, you know, you and I are both Damian Lillard believers. And I think, I don't want to speak for you.
I had him first team this year.
You had him first team?
Over Steph, yeah.
Just, games played and
games
to his
played,
team.
Body of work, influence on the floor, shoring up a defensive weakness. I think going from being below average to average,
yeah, average. And by the way, average. Would you can do that on
hey,
offense?
Exactly. I mean, it just full body of work.
So to
durability.
To your point about he's become such a crafty pick and roll player. Now I understand Steven Adams is not Anthony Davis. And Steven Adams isn't even Mirotic in terms of just foot speed, right? But he's very smart. He's good. He's physical. He's comfortable playing that style. Last year, Damian Lillard choked is too strong of a word, but New Orleans defense, by game three, you could see it. He lost his confidence. He didn't know what to do. He was flustered. This, a year later, now again, Steven Adams isn't the same. A year later, I've talked about it before. I'm not going to get into the specifics of it, but he's just better. With more antidotes to that trapping, blitzing, up to touch, whatever you want to call it. And he played Steven Adams off the floor. It was the exact opposite. They had to take Steven Adams and say, hey man, you're pretty good. You're not good enough. We need to, and there was a three that Dame made in game four in Oklahoma City where Adams was late coming up. He wasn't even at the 3-point line, which is unusual for him to miss. Now, whoever was guarding Dame got smashed by the screen. So that was a problem too. And Dame just waltzed into one. And that was the last one in that game. Right after that, they moved Adams onto Harkless. And you could see, I don't know if Adams was tired or whatever, but Damian Lillard, who wore down last year under that kind of pressure, wore down the other team this year.
Yeah, it was interesting because I wasn't sure if it was because, like, Harkless kept getting beneath the defense, you know, kind of sliding in, getting those seals and whatever. And I don't know what the adjustment was. It was funny because I just did this piece last week on sort of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Trae Young learning the position.
I can't say Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's name. I sound drunk. Shai Gilgeous. There's a lot of shushing when I say it. I can't. SGA is like
a Toronto native.
Yes, incidentally, yes. That's right.
In listening to those kids kind of talk about what they're really studying are guys, in this, what you just said with Dame and kind of how crafty he's gotten. They love to study craftiness. They both volunteered to me without my even saying it. They study Mike Conley. They also study kind of Kyle Lowry. They study the guys who kind of find the hacks in middle agehood of being a point guard. And Dame has gotten so smart. Again, as you said, like it's not some, there's been a turn. He's graduated to that. This isn't going to be a function of speed or explosiveness or even a great pick or a function of the deep. It's just I'm going to identify the slit in the space that is going to allow me to do this. And then, of course, the final shot has nothing to do with any of that, right? which is the funniest of all is Nate Silver had a great tweet this morning where, you know, he's like, well, actually, you know, kind of where he kind of mocked what many of us would normally do, which is like, and what Paul George actually said after
Paul
the
George
game.
Did say it.
It's a bad shot. By the way, Paul George isn't wrong.
Well, the one reason it's good is I do think the math would suggest Lamar Hurd, who I love, he's the Blazers color commentator, yeah. And he just tweeted.
Oh, isn't he great?
He's fantastic.
I got to know him in Los Angeles.
People are sleeping on how good that broadcast team is. He was frozen in that spot. He tweeted a video of himself. He hasn't moved like an hour after the game because he can't believe what he's just seen. And wait a second, I lost my train of thought. What were we talking about?
We were talking about the kind of the well actually function.
Oh, and
quality of that shot.
And he was surprised. That's right. He was surprised that he was like, I didn't think Dame was going to take it like all the way to the end where you don't even get a chance to rebound the ball. And I actually think the math, I think, again, I haven't had time this morning to look back at the studies, but I think the math would suggest in that situation, you should take it to the end.
Especially with a half-court inbound. Yeah. I mean, teams can do stuff with a second.
Yeah, you should not even give them anything. You should take it to the end and then go to overtime as your worst-case scenario. And it's just a cold-blooded MFN shot. I mean, I don't want to have beeps today because we're not in Bristol. The beep button is that there's like a two-step beep process now. And then the wave goodbye.
What, like a 7-second delay kind of thing?
I don't know. No, they beep it. They beep it. But now I don't want to burden the Toronto people.
And I'm glad you've disclosed this now so I can be more cautious.
And the wave goodbye was just ice cold.
So this is the thing. I think we can divide superstars, and I think you can do this in every sport, into hot and cold. Right? Dame is cold. Even the watch. Look at the expression on the face. Is there a howl? Is there a primal scream? Right? Like, Russ is hot. He's rocking the cradle. He's yelling, you know. Kawhi with the fist pump and that's it. Dame is cold. I mean, this is sort of Barry Sanders versus, I don't know enough about football, like kind of who is the hot running back who...
I feel like the wide receivers are hotter than the running backs. The wide receivers, I feel like when I was a kid, had the most...
Billy White Shoes Johnson was who I grew up with.
And they had Michael Irvin. They had the most Terrell Owens.
And I love the cold guys. Dame, Kawhi. And then you have like guys who aren't on the continuum at all, like James Harden, who's just kind of weird. In a great way. And I don't know if his reactions are cold or hot. They're sort of this third axis.
So Damian Lillard in this series, 33 points per game. Pretty good. I believe he shot 48% from three. I'm bringing up his numbers now. And just, you know, this is a team. I have my first round winners and losers coming up tomorrow after last night broke perfectly for that. You know, I thought they were done. I thought that series for them last year was going to be unrecoverable. I thought it would break them in a fundamental way that they could not come back from. I thought they'll go through this year. They didn't make any changes in the offseason because they almost did. They got very close to firing Terry Stotts. Neil Olshey fought for him. They fought for the stability of the team.
By the way, counterfactual, Terry ends up in Phoenix last year. I mean,
that's a great coaching job. Would you take the Phoenix coaching job right now if they offered it to you?
Only 30.
Huh?
They're only 30.
They're like 29.5 now.
Yeah.
And the Phoenix is like 0.5 of a head coaching
job.
I don't think I would take it. Not, but by the way, not that either of us would, are qualified. Obviously, this is a joke. But I think if I did take it, I would do all sorts of crazy things. Anyway, it's like
I would wear nicer suits.
I would too.
I would really go for the suit.
I would wear no tie for sure.
I'm more Spo Kenny Atkinson on this.
Yeah, and like if I had been Dwayne Casey, this is why, because you get fired for doing this. But if I had been Dwayne Casey, I'm facing the Bucks. I have no chance. Blake Griffin misses the first two games. I like really have no chance. Mm-hmm. I am doing the, and I talked to a coach from a Western Conference team. We were just shooting the breeze about this, and he unprompted said, "Why aren't they shooting like 75 threes? I would just have just done, let's just see how it works. Let's just play 4 point guards and shoot 75 threes. Well, I don't even know what we're talking about. Portland.
Yeah, we were talking about Portland. You thought this would fundamentally break them.
And the opposite has happened. And look, the bracket, I don't even think the bracket broke right for them. They didn't want this matchup and they got it anyway and they won. And I think it's a remarkable story of perseverance and self-assurance. And it starts with Dame. And you and I think are both believers in like, this guy sets a culture where, it's just rock solid. And I think they did not pretend that last season didn't happen. Opposite. They gave themselves time to hurt and look in the mirror and feel the pain of it.
Oh, they've had relatively public therapy.
Yeah.
On this. And I love it. I mean, look, narrative's easy to ascribe after the fact, but I love the idea that a loss, a sweep like that can be a catalyzing event for a team.
I believed it. I was out there for a week early this season. You've spent a lot of time around them. I believed it, but you just didn't know if it would matter in the playoffs, right? You just didn't know if they're going to get in the playoffs and they're going to get a bad matchup, and it's just not going to matter. But they believed it. They believed we are coming back from this stronger. CJ McCollum told me earlier in the season, we don't have to be scared anymore in the playoffs, because it's never going to be worse than
right,
that.
Right, exactly.
It's never going to be
rock
worse.
Bottom. You have lost a series in which you were favored by a 4-0 margin.
Humiliated.
Every vulnerability you have, every suspicion people have had about your inadequacies as a team have been exposed on national television 4 times. And yet they kept it together. And I'm a big fan of continuity. More because I do think there's value in familiarity. I think teams, if we look back, like I think we can look back and say, if not for LeBron, like that Indiana team overachieved relative to its collective talents, under Frank Vogel, that 2010, the George West, Hill teams. I just think sticking together has aggregate value. Now I think it can get stale, but there's nothing in Portland's kind of portfolio that suggests to me, oh, it was stale.
See, that
it didn't work.
It's really an art determining stale versus whatever the opposite of stale is, but still has continuity. I don't know what the right adjective for that would be. The Clippers got stale.
Oh yeah,
the Blazers didn't get stale, and I don't know where one begins and the other ends. If there's an inevitability where at some point you get stale, where at some point if they lose this series,
maybe ask the question: do I still like coming to work with these people?
Yeah, maybe it's personalities. Right. Maybe it's not even accumulated failures, because the Blazers have had as many accumulated failures, albeit with lower expectations, than those Clippers teams did in the playoffs.
Well, so the Blazers are funny. So one of the things that happened is they got ahead of schedule, right? Like we remember 2016. That was supposed to be a rebuild year.
Post-LaMarcus.
Right. They win a series. Granted, Chris and Blake both go out against the Clippers, but they win it. So now they're ahead of schedule.
That was the year for like a hot second. It looked like things were breaking the Clippers' way, and then everybody got hurt immediately.
And then in 2017, and remind me if I'm wrong, I think they bow out to the Warriors again.
Yes.
So they played par golf, right? Like we thought they were the fourth or fifth best team.
It reminded me, the Portland-Toronto comparisons are irresistible in that, so you lose to the Warriors. What does that say about your team? You lost to the Warriors. Who cares? It's like the Raptors. Oh, they choke in the playoffs every year. Actually, they choked against Washington 1 year, and then they lost to LeBron like a bunch of times. Okay, you lost to LeBron. Like, what are you going to do? Everyone loses to LeBron except the Warriors.
So, can we talk about OKC for a second?
Oh, yes, but I'm not. Yes, we'll get back to Portland. I'm such a believer. This is a league that disparages prolonged goodness. Being good for a long time is disparaged. Not even treadmill of mediocrity. Forget that. Being 48 to 52 wins good. Not mediocre. Good. Is like, what's the point? What's the point? This, whoever makes the conference finals from that side of the bracket, everyone's going to laugh at that side of the bracket. Oh, it's the boring side. No one's going to watch it. If there were an NBA TV conference semifinals, it would be whatever that series is. Whoever makes it is going to be a great story. Portland is a great story. By the way, their second best player this season was Yusuf Nurkic, and he got hurt. And then he shows up last night like freaking Willis Reed in street clothes, and the whole crowd goes crazy. Denver would be a great story. Now, did they tank and manipulate the bracket and all that stuff and threaten the basketball gods? Yes, but they're a young up-and-coming team with a totally idiosyncratic superstar. And the Spurs, if they make it, it's just like you just can't kill the Spurs. They're the White Walkers of the NBA. Portland is a story of people in this league disparage prolonged goodness, and they have a chance to make the conference finals. And if you make the conference finals, that's a hell of a season.
No, and this is a conversation I've had with small market CEOs and everything. And you know, Memphis was a team I hung around a lot during the grit and grind era. And the question is there virtue to, as you say, winning 48 to 53 wins every year, generally winning a round, sometimes winning two, and treating a market to just a core that they can recognize that has an identity.
To that moment last night.
Right. And it's one of the great riddles. I mean, is it bad business? Is it bad fandom? And I grew up with a team like that. I mean, I grew up with the consummate, very good for a very long time.
The Hawks.
The Hawks of the 1980s. Never got to a conference final. Not unlike Portland, yet had the same core of Wilkins, Willis, Rivers. It was Whitman and Theus and, you know, the Tree Rollins and then no John Konkak, oy vey. But, you know, that was Antoine Carnicle. I can name those guys, and it was that team won 50 games every frigging year and never got to a conference final. I look back on it with positive nostalgia, and I think that's always going to be a question for the Utah Jazz. I mean, that's going to be a question for the Utah Jazz. They might bow out in the next 48 hours, and this is a team that could be very good for a very long time.
Yeah, I think the Utah – I don't want to get sidetracked, but I do think – I was talking to a few people at the Raptors game last night about how should I process if Houston wins tomorrow, and this is now 8-2 against Utah in the last two postseasons. Is it just a bad matchup? Like Houston's just really good, and James Harden is a nightmare for Gobert specifically. Or – is there something regular season-y about the Jazz? Is there something about them that they can win a lot of games in the regular season, but whether it's Gobert is one of these sort of classic hang-back rim protectors and they only really have one guy who can just get stuff done one-on-one and all their cute stuff doesn't work as well in the playoffs. So their cute handoff, oh, look at the cutting and the do. They run into the catch and they do this all nerdy stuff that I love. It doesn't work. And the answer to that is – the answer I got last night from a bunch of people was – all over the place. Some people, maybe it's just a bad matchup and Utah is actually just really good. And if they had a different matchup, they would roll through some of these other teams in the West. I don't know the answer, but it's an interesting question if they lose tonight.
Right.
Anyway, talk about OKC.
Yeah, so where do they go from here? I'm pulling up the salary sheet. Because they have a lot on the books. They have demonstrated this season they are a very good, but not exceptional team. That could change, but when you want to gauge change, you kind of look at a roster of those commitments and say, which of these guys is getting better and which of these guys' skills are falling off a little bit. You know, Russ at this point, I mean, here's a loaded question, and it's going to seem like a hater question, and it's not a hater question. Other than John Wall, name the contracts in basketball that are less favorable to their team than Russell Westbrook's. Maybe have Kevin Love.
Hold on. Let me get warmed up. Yeah, ask the question again.
Okay. Name the NBA contracts that are less favorable to their teams than Russell Westbrook's. And I'm putting John Wall on that list. I'm asking if Kevin Love is on that list. Are there others?
Next question. I had to, sorry.
Yeah, that's superb.
People! One of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth, and most of us don't even do it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers to make sure you are doing it properly, and it's simple, affordable, and it makes brushing enjoyable. It has little sensitive sonic vibrations that are gentle enough on sensitive gums. Why? Because people brush too hard sometimes, or some electric toothbrushes are too abrasive. Not Quip! It has a built-in 2-minute timer with pulses every 30 seconds so that you switch sides and brush for the dentist recommended 2 minutes. If you actually sat here and counted 1 to 120, you'd realize 2 minutes can kind of feel like a long time. You might be shortchanging it. Up to 90% of us, in fact, don't brush for a full 2 minutes or don't clean evenly. We're lefty or righty heavy. That's why I love Clip and why they're backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. That is a lot of dental professionals. That's an NBA stadium arena of dental professionals. Quip starts at just $25. I always imagined a high-end electric toothbrush would be like triple digits at least. $25, that is, if you go to getquip.com/low, my last name of the name of this podcast, right now, and you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/low.
I had this conversation with an executive I really, really respect. I mean, I respect all of them, but a guy that I think is particularly good, 3 months ago over dinner in anonymous City X, and he ranked at number 2 before this. And let's not mince words. This playoff run, it's not a run. This playoff fall is a disaster for Russell Westbrook. A disaster. He shot, I think, 36% from the field, much worse than that from three-point range. He was the worst pull-up jump shooter in the entire NBA this year. The worst, statistically. 104 guys took at least 3 pull-ups a game. He was number 104. Interestingly, he shot 65% at the rim, which is his best figure ever. But then you have these games where he's just throwing it up at the backboard. Mark that one down. And last night, on their final possession, he goes one-on-one at Aminu. Can't get any lift off the ground. I mean, you freeze it at the moment of release. He's barely off the ground and throws up garbage at the rim, and then the game ends. And by the way, comebacks, when you blow a 15-point lead in 6 minutes, it starts innocently. And what that started with was a Russell Westbrook sloppy closeout on C.J. McCollum in the right corner, just veering out of control for no reason, C.J. floater. Same thing happened again 2 minutes later in the left quarter. Just got blown by. His defense has been overrated for a long time. I think it was okay this year, but this idea that he had become some sort of stopper was ridiculous. You'll watch him when he gets screened at the three-point line and the screen hits. He's just out of the play. He's just gone. The shooting is just, there's just no way around it. I mean, this is a disastrous playoff run for him, and I don't know what you do because you're looking at the contract. To answer your question, I think only John Wall's is worse.
Yeah.
38 next year, 41, 44, 47. Sam Presti has done magic spinning all of these bad contracts into players that help the team. So, like, Reggie Jackson begets Enes Kanter, begets Carmelo Anthony, begets Dennis Schroeder, right? Who is a helpful player. That musical chairs are going to stop at some point. I don't know. The popular suggestion is going to be, well, they have to trade Steven Adams. To who?
Right. In a league where the market for bigs.
Who's dying to pay? I love Steven Adams. A good player.
I love Steven Adams.
If you gave me the list of who would I like to get a beer with in the NBA, he's top 5. I don't know any teams dying to pay him $26 million next year and $27.5 the year after that. They're stuck. I think there's going to be Billy Donovan speculation starting, like, right now. And because I just don't know what else
you think,
do.
I just, Presti seems really committed to Donovan, and there's just a history and an admiration there. And is it Billy's fault? So if you're evaluating, and again, this is what drives me crazy about organizations I've written about in the last few months, the Lakers, is okay, let's say you want to fire a coach. What evaluative process do you take to fire that coach? You obviously you want to look at the evidence. You've been watching it in real time, and then you sort of get to the end of the season. You say, to what extent does Billy Donovan have accountability for this, or is it we just need to kind of shake things up? The Thunder seems so process oriented. I just can't imagine them employing that evaluation and coming to the determination in sort of a process oriented way and saying, yeah. It's on Billy. I don't know that it is or it's not on Billy. I don't know. I don't have that information, right? Like, I don't watch Billy Donovan in real time. I don't see what it's like around the facility. I'm not there. Like, I don't know. I mean, one of the, you know, I said to a league official last year, I'm like, I don't think we should vote on Coach of the Year anymore. And they're like, well, why? And I was like, because I'm not there. I'm not there when the conversations that matter happen. I'm not there. I see game adjustments. I see 10% of their grade. I just don't think the media should be voting on that award. Now, I don't know who should, but – and that's the thing with Billy. I just don't think a process-oriented organization is – I mean, maybe they will.
By the way, that's not sourced. That's just me saying this is typically what happens when a team is trapped like this and they've had a couple consecutive – I'm not saying I've heard any rumblings.
So question, is there a chance of Russell Westbrook developing a Jason Kidd shooting renaissance late in career? He's only 20 – well, how old is Russ? 29?
Something like that.
All right. He's 29, 30? It's not too late. Is it too late? I don't know enough about his mechanics, his raw mechanics, to know whether it's a shot that's amenable to
Russ's
proficiency.
30.5 almost on the dot.
And when did Jason really start?
Around this time, maybe even a little later.
So there, that's one solution, right, is the compensation for the lack of elevation and explosiveness is the enhanced shot, and all of a sudden he becomes a 37, 38, 39% three-point shooter and forgoes the long twos that are just asinine and kill 6 to 8 possessions a game, which is far too many in a league where plus or minus, what, 3, 4, 5 is really the margin of most games.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, he's just, in terms of volume and inefficiency, he's nothing like Jason Kidd was. I mean, Jason Kidd was sort of like a three avoider or a wide open 3-point shot taker before he became an okay
You're
wide
right.
open 3-point shooter.
Temperamentally, it's different.
This is just, it's different. And, you know, I just don't know.
So they're stuck.
Look, this is the same general manager who turned Serge Ibaka into Paul George. So, like, I'm sure they have 5 contingency plans. I'm sure they've thought ahead. I'm sure they've targeted 20 different trades that they think are possible. I just don't know what you do. And I just think you zoom out. We are going to get a book about the Thunder at some point by somebody and what happened and what could have been. And I don't know what you think of this, actually, because the Harden trade will be the sort of definitional moment of – it will be the inflection point, even more than KD leaving. I think the Harden trade will be the one.
Yes.
And people viewed that as, well, the Thunder chose Ibaka over Harden because they were simultaneous. They were the same offseason, right? I mean, Ibaka signed his extension, and then a few months later, I believe, Harden was traded. I think the most fundamental choice they made was Westbrook over Harden. I think that if that was a real choice between two ball handlers, and now Russ was a year ahead of Harden, so his contract timetable was
accelerated. Trying to remember the timing.
Right.
Was
so,
it? Right.
So that pushes you naturally, like we lock this guy up first. Okay, so now we have him.
That's a funny counterfactual, right? What if Harden were first?
Yeah, and KD is not a choice. Like, they chose to keep KD. They wanted to keep KD. The only way, someone framed this to me yesterday before the game, the only way you can say they didn't actively choose KD enough, if that makes any sense, was should they have investigated trading Russ? If they thought that that was a reason that Kevin might leave, by not doing that, by not at least investigating it, did they push Kevin out the door? I don't know that's true. I have no idea. Yeah. No one knows. Kevin will never cop to why he left, other than he life changed.
And at that point, obviously, Harden's gone. So it's
Harden's
not,
already
right,
gone.
So,
so to me, Russ Harden was the choice. And it's remarkable that Russ is the only one left. And the Harden trade has been done to death, right? We've all done it to death.
Yes.
It was framed as a financial trade, which to me never made sense because they got so close to offering Harden the max that they could have that it's like, well, if you're going to offer that, then offer the whole thing. It got framed as a let's spin a redundant star into 4 or 5 bites at the apple that can sort of sustain our team going forward with draft picks and younger players. I think, and again, this is just years down the line, having talked to lots and lots of people around the league, I think what really happened is they just didn't think James Harden was someone they wanted on their team at the price it was going to take. They just didn't think he stood for what they wanted to stand for as an organization, and they didn't think he was as good as he ended up being. And by the way, people that were in the trade market for him also didn't think he was this good. Houston was one of the few teams that thought he was this good. And I remember talking to one Rockets official at the time, after the trade and said, well, would you take Harden or Russ? And I said, well, I think Russ is probably better. He said, we'll see.
Yeah, was the Beal deal ever on the table?
I care.
Culturally, Russ was a more representative fit, let's say.
I think the off-court stuff with Harden bothered them. I don't think that's why they traded him, but I think it contributed to this idea that this guy stands for what we want and this guy maybe doesn't, and let's see what we can do.
Yeah.
Wrong choice.
Yeah, and the question I've always had is, was there a line in the sand drawn by ownership, as ownerships want to do? Maybe, was that number the number that, here it is, this is what we'll pay, and this is the line? I mean, that's a question I have. Again, there's not a more tight-lipped organization than Oklahoma City. I don't know that you'll ever get your book.
This is just my theory. It's my informed theory. I think people have, in all the analysis of the Harden trade, six and whatever years later, I think the angle that they did not think he was this good is underplayed. I think all the other factors are overplayed, and they just flat didn't think he was this good.
Right. We were having a conversation in 2012 about Cephalosha versus Harden. As late as that.
Yeah. And
also, I love Tabo, but.
And also just like, you know, all the, they could have amnestied Perkins and this and that. It's like, I just think flat out, I don't think they've ever thought James. And by the way, there's no way you could have predicted this, what James Harden has become. There's no way. There's a 240 step back threes was not in the collective imagination of the NBA 3 years ago. It wasn't, let alone 6 years ago. So anyway, that's enough of OKC. Portland is just, Dame is legit. CJ made some, I'm a bad man. That's why when he makes like a mid-range jumper in someone's face, I say 355 fourth quarter CJ.
You've played around obviously with Second Spectrum and those stats and that QA, like the shot probability in excess of
CJ's outcome. High.
CJ is ridiculous. I mean, he is the best hard shot maker in the league.
And he made a bunch in this series. Yeah. He quietly had a very good series.
Yes.
And so that series is over. Almost all the series are over now, or on the verge of being over.
Yeah, what do we got? We got the Houston, gentlemen sweep potentially,
and the Clippers Warriors tonight, gentlemen sweep probability.
I think a gentleman sweep has to be you win the first two at home and you yield one of the two on the road.
I didn't know that there was a particular order of events that needed to be followed.
For instance, we just saw the Raptors polish off. I don't think just any 4-1 out to credit. I think Matt Moore and Graydon Gordian came up with this conceit. I think it's more that it just kind of goes true to form. First two at home, and then there's never a moment when you doubt the outcome of the series. There's never a moment where it's tied except for 0-0. You win your first two at home. You're the favorite team. You drop one of two on the road, and you come back.
And you let the opposing home fans have a nice moment.
Exactly. Like, I think that's the notion of the gentleman. It's not any 4-1
series. So Raptors Magic was not a gentleman sweep.
That's not a gentleman sweep. Magic won game one. There was panic. It was just it has to be more pro forma, I think.
People, this show is sponsored, as it often is, by SeatGeek. The ticket industry hasn't changed that much in a long time. There's a bunch of big companies who have been around forever, but they don't really care about making the experience easier for you, the customer. SeatGeek is there to change all that. It has 50,000, actually more than 50,000 five-star reviews in the App Store, and it's focused on making your experience easy. It pulls in millions of tickets from all over the web. It's one-stop shopping. You don't have to click around to a million sites out of fear that you've missed a really good deal. It rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10. It has an interactive seat map. It has green dots for good deals, red dots for less good deals. It's very simple. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. It is by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. Whenever I have a friend from out of town, I need to buy him a ticket to a game, I go there. They've helped me with Broadway shows, comedy shows, you name it. Everything, they have it. Best of all, my listeners get $10 off their first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do, download the SeatGeek app. Enter promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Bam, $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Remember, that's promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, for $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase.
You were on Toronto, Orlando.
I was.
Let's talk about
Toronto. I'm very happy to be in Toronto.
Love the T-Dot. Could have robbed a bank last night. I tried to rope you into it. I said the Leafs are playing game 7. Could rob a bank. No one's paying attention. Anything you wanted to do. It's like... I think it was the Die Hard movie where the little kid Die Hard with whatever the third Die Hard movie is, where the little kid tells Bruce Willis, look at all the cops.
I've only seen the one with Alan Rickman.
Well, that's the best one.
Okay.
He tells all the cops are up to something. You could rob City Hall. And Bruce Willis has the aha moment of something's wrong here. That's what Toronto is like on a hockey day. I thought, so before the playoffs on the Woj Low TV special that aired on Friday, April, whatever, I said, I'm picking the Raptors to make the finals out of the East. Game one disturbed me. Games two through five were like, okay, that's
they're really good.
That's the team.
Zach, they're really good. And I wrote about it last night, published this morning. For all of the drama that has begotten this franchise, I mean, trading a franchise star, the Kawhi coming in, is it a rental, is it not? Dwayne Casey out, Nick Nurse in, midseason trades, just the weight of anxiety that's on this fan base, whether you believe they've underachieved or just run into LeBron. And, like, when all the smoke cleared, and then they never are on the floor together, 161 minutes, you know, like, what we saw the last 2 weeks is just a defense that is brutal.
Monstrous.
Zach, they on the floor have two defensive players of the year, and I know Gasol's older, but he's wise. And he just actually manhandled. They got nothing in the series. By the way, those just two guys. Then you have Danny Green, who I voted on the second team all defense this year and is the best transitional defender in the league, and a pretty damn good base defender too. Then you have Kyle Lowry, consistently top 3, 4, and 5 at his position.
He drew three charges last night.
I was like,
can you take him out of the game before he hurts himself? Stop.
And then, by the way, then the last guy, who might be better than all of them this season.
He might be the best one.
Pascal Siakam, who's also on my second team all defense this year. I'll say nothing of like Serge Ibaka and Fred VanVleet coming in. I mean, usually you sacrifice a little defense when you bring in the second team. Not in Toronto when you bring in Ibaka and VanVleet. It is just, they are, for all, and you know, Nick Nurse kind of came through the Rio Grande. We knew him as his offensive guy, a shoot 71 threes in a game. And by the way, he has devised a defense that is just this perfect, sits at the intersection of sort of Stan Van Gundy's conservatism, stay at home, and let's like flood the help side.
Yeah.
You know, it's this wonderful, like adaptable, very smart, with very surgical coverages that when there's a demand, we want to blitz Terrence Ross. We can do that. And by the way, because we completely trust the help system in this organization or in the scheme. And I'm just kind of overcome with what I saw in the last five games, which is just an absolute defensive clinic. Granted, Zach, against a offense in Orlando that is not exactly,
average. No, but they're showing stuff. They're showing not only the individual talent, but a growing connectivity between them. There are a couple, the one play that stood out for me, so it's a stupid little thing, but in game four, I think, Gordon and Isaac ran a pick and roll on the right wing. And the Raptors had the matchups reversed. Siakam was on Gordon and Kawhi was on Isaac, I think, and it was the reverse for almost the entire series. And the Magic read that and thought, okay, they're gonna switch. And so Isaac slipped the screen because that's how you beat a switch. You slip, get the hell out of there before they can switch. And they didn't switch. And it was one of those moments where like they just made a read in a second, in a millisecond, to not do what they probably thought they were going to do because they anticipated what the Magic were going to do. Gasol made three or four plays like that in the same game where there was one pick and roll where, he was laid back as usually as he was, you know, 3 feet, 4 feet below the 3-point arc, saw right away that his guard was in trouble, stepped out and like pretty fast for Marc Gasol, stepped out, got his hand, big paw up, either got a piece of the shot or disrupted it. And I talked to Mark a little bit after the game last night, and he's like, it's coming together. Yeah. We're starting to come together.
And again, I like a team that knows how to solve problems. They had a problem after game one. I mean, DJ Augustin's a pretty good pick-and-roll practitioner.
Had a nice season for them.
Yep. And so they build this high wall, and it stops everything. It says Mark. You know, I remember this reminds me of a conversation. I've talked about it on this podcast, I think, before. But, you know, read and react. We always associate reads with being an offensive skill, right? And that's generally, you know, talking about a Dame last night. I mean, Dame's gotten so good at reading, it's insane. Underrated is the defensive read. Is having a defense that is so smart. Al Horford is sort of the king of this. And I remember this was the origin of the conversation was Atlanta had that second ranked defense when they won 60 games. No one could really figure out. The personnel's kind of, Jeff Teague and Kyle Corey. Yeah. And ultimately it was, is that, and then I'm like, your coverage schemes are just so complex. And Al's like, what do you mean? I mean, I said, well, you guys did this to that. And then on the 1-4, he's like, oh, no, those were all reads. Yeah. Like, wait, I don't understand. Defensive reads. And I think just IQ, and this team is so smart defensively. It is so good. Kawhi is brilliant. I mean, he's a savant at these situations.
And he's had a couple of plays, particularly in game four in Orlando, where it was like he came out of nowhere and pinned a shot on the backboard and swiped the ball. And you're like, uh-oh, that looks almost like 2 years ago, Kawhi.
He is the best defensive helper in the history.
Now, I don't think he's quite back to 2 years ago, because 2 years ago you couldn't dribble near him. He would just be like, I'm taking the ball. Thank you. I'm now going to go the other direction. Thank you for participating in this interaction that we've had. He's not quite there, but they've been really, really good defensively. And as you said, Orlando is no great shakes offensively. So we'll see. You know, they're about to – these semis are going to be as advertised, I think.
Yeah. I'm really curious to see how Philly deals with it. They're really creative.
What are your early thoughts on this matchup? What do you got for me?
I mean, I think they obviously have a new situation. They haven't had to sort of say, what do we do with this too? You know, do we top lock JJ? Do we, you know, how do we deal with real motion? I mean, real motion. I'm not talking about 1-4 and 1-5 pick and rolls. I'm not talking about, all right, let's free up Aaron Gordon in some space. I'm talking about legitimate motion that compromises and leverages. Like Joel Embiid is not going to be susceptible to the sort of bullying that Marc Gasol was able to perpetrate on Nikola Vucevic.
Yeah, he stole Vucevic's lunch in this series. Yeah. I felt bad for Vucevic. Wait, yeah. 6 years to get in the playoffs, and then Marc Gasol just eat your lunch for five games.
Now it's interesting. The Raptors were willing to double Vuce when Gasol wasn't on him. Are they going to have to do that? Are they going to play him straight up with Mark? Or are they going to kind of? I mean, what contingencies do they have? I mean, they can blitz JJ the way they handled. They handled Ross. I don't know, but I think there are more pressure valves and releases in Philadelphia.
Well,
that than
is
are
if you if you blitz Ross and the other four guys on the court are Michael Carter Williams, Kem Birch, Jonathan Isaac, and Wes Iwundu, it doesn't really matter.
Right. And obviously the other four guys aren't going to be that. And then it's going to be a really interesting series. I think Toronto has, I think, one of the three or four best transition defenses in the league. That'll help, but. Still, you can only do so much against Ben Simmons rolling at 6'10", you know, down the floor. It's going to be interesting. I mean, I'll take Toronto.
I'm going to pick Toronto too.
You know, but I want to see a game or two. I mean, it's
the Embiid question is really interesting in terms of what do you go into game one. What's your first look defensively going to be on Embiid? Obviously, Mark is going to guard him. Do you give Mark four possessions of just, we're sending nothing. We're sending no help. Let's see how it looks. I bet they'll just land on some sort of like half help, half like not, they're not, I don't think they need to double him. I don't think you get Mark, I don't think you trade for Marc Gasol to then hard double Joel Embiid consistently unless he really earns it. I think they'll shade and do something, but you know.
But here's the brilliance, Zach, and this is what we just talked about for 10 minutes. The luxury of your Nick Nurse of saying to Kawhi or Danny or Pat, be smart about it. Yeah. Help, like, fine. You know how to identify when a teammate, you know, when Joel gets deeper than he was supposed to on the catch. Like, go. Be smart about it. We're not going to devise a specific standard, but you know how to do this. You're Kawhi Leonard. You know, you're Danny Green. Like you know how – you know when and how you have luxuries to come off the corner or don't or when – you know, when the help side is compromised and when it's not. And I just think that's the luxury of having. I mean, in many respects, you know, Mike Budenholzer has the same luxury. I think Steve Kerr, when the Warriors are actually engaged defensively, has the same luxury. The luxury of just saying, be smart. That's the help scheme. Be smart. Be selective.
It's like when the Warriors, I think it was their first finals, I was talking to one of their coaches about how well they switch. And he's like, yeah, you know, I've had coaches from other teams call me. Say, hey, you have any tips for, you know, teaching our guys how to do this? Like, how to switch? Like, you guys, you have any drills? You have any, you know, whatever? And he's like, no, just get really smart players.
Yeah.
Like,
intelligence is the most underrated quality in the playoffs.
Just a question of who's guarding Redick. Is it, I assume Kyle will start on that assignment, but Kyle likes to guard. I could see Kyle being like, let me get some shots at Jimmy Butler. He likes to guard the big guys who try and take him into the post and stonewall him with his giant ass.
Switch on they willingly, Toronto switches Kyle on the post in like 1-4 sets.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the numbers, he's kind of has a little Chris Paul, has the same thing, which is there are certain guys. you want to play mismatched basketball and just kind of scratch the record and halt the entire set and try to post up? Go. Fine.
Yeah, and who does Simmons guard on the? I mean, in Simmons and Butler, and to a much lesser extent Harris, they have guys who you can physically stack up with Kawhi. Now, I don't think Harris can guard Kawhi. He's just not quick enough. He's too upright as a defender. You know, but Simmons guarded D'Angelo Russell for essentially the entire first round. He's been there against elite point guards. He's been, I think, their best choice and most frequent choice. So if he's guarding Lowry, who guards Kawhi? Is it going to be Jimmy Butler? Is he up for that? I think he's probably up for that. But I think Kawhi's got some length on him. And Kawhi just like, you got to have a really strong, physical, long guy for Kawhi. And like, Jimmy's good. I think Jimmy will be all right in that. This is a fun matchup because there are some good physical matchups. Like, the Raptors have Marc Gasol on Embiid and Embiid on Gasol. That's a great physical matchup. And whether it's Siakam or most likely to start Kawhi, they have guys who can, like, Kawhi has really, really hurt Ben Simmons. Like, Ben Simmons hasn't been able to do anything with Kawhi. They have guys who can physically match up with each other, and that's interesting.
And by the way, I don't be surprised if Siakam finds his way on Simmons for a bit.
Siakam guards everyone. Siakam's like, randomly, he'll go 3-minute stretches like he's guarding Evan Fournier now.
He guarded John Wall last season. Yeah. It changed the series against Washington.
Spicy P. Yeah, it turns out he's good. It's not fake. It wasn't fake.
It's good.
He's really good.
I gave him an all second team vote.
And, you know, he's a good one-on-one player too. And, you know, when the Magic went to their lineups that only had one of Gordon and just had Gordon, no Isaac, and so Gordon's guarding Kawhi, and you have a smaller wing on Pascal, it was like a layup every time. There's nothing you can do. I think it's going to be a fun matchup. Rebounding to me is one thing I'm going to look for because Toronto is a shaky defensive rebounding team. Gasol helped, and Philly is just a monstrous offensive rebounding team. That's one area where I get a little worried if I'm Toronto. And this is also a series where they could use Anunoby because you just any guy of that size against a team like Philly is handy, and I don't know what his prognosis is. But it should be fun.
Yeah.
Milwaukee-Boston is going to be a lot of fun.
Very fun.
I think I have to write a preview for that for the weekend, so I've been watching some film on that one. That's going to
I got to think about it. I've kind of not seen either of those teams. It's just been the night I haven't been around.
I saw all of Boston-Indiana. I'm not going to lie. About halfway through game three, I kind of checked out of Milwaukee-Detroit.
What are the Celtics doing well right now?
Well,
because I haven't seen them in a couple weeks.
Defensively, they've been tremendous, but Indiana's a pretty limited offensive team. Kyrie's shot making has been crazy. Horford looks like Horford, and Horford stands as perhaps the most pivotal player in the entire second round because he's going to guard Giannis a lot, and if he's not up for it, or if Giannis can figure out how to win that matchup decisively, that changes things. Hayward has looked comfortable and good, and they've started to close games with that lineup that was their starting lineup both last season and this season. They're just playing well. Everyone's attacking the basket instead of settling for shots.
In Milwaukee, I saw a little bit of game three. How's Sterling Brown looking?
Good, very good. And he's Brogdon also looms over the series. Like, right. If Brogdon can't go for some of the series, Sterling Brown, I think, becomes a very important player, as does Mirotic. That'll be a good series. We're going to have some good stuff going on. Did you see any of Denver last night?
I've seen zero of that series. It's like, that series is on when I'm writing my game stuff. It's been paired with the Toronto series so much. So it's like, it's my one series I am totally ignorant of.
I think it's been a fun series. No one cares about it really, but I think it's been a fun series. Denver winning in San Antonio in game four and then stomping them last night is really, really impressive because in game three, game two, Jamal Murray wakes up for 6 minutes and just has an out of body experience and they win. After looking terrible in game one and terrible before that in game two. Game three, Barton is bad. Murray is bad again. And Murray looks like broken again in game three. Like, he's passing up open threes and like dribbling into floaters but losing the ball and being skittish. And you can say, uh-oh, this looks – now they're staring down game four in San Antonio. They look sort of fraught. They look frazzled. And then they pull that out and then they stomp yesterday. It's an impressive couple of games. Torrey Craig going into the starting lineup has been huge.
He's a good defender.
And last night was their best, I thought, perimeter defensive game. Gary Harris's defense was awesome early in the game. Just a really nice, Really nice effort. Let's talk about the Suns.
Yeah, sure.
So about a month ago, you wrote a whole entire feature that about the Suns and Robert Sarver and goats defecating in Ryan McDonough's office. And just kind of a, like, what happened? What happened to one of the league's, if not glamour franchises, like a consistent winner, a franchise the league could be proud of, a franchise that had been innovative with 7 seconds or less and had been one of the great consistent winning teams that hadn't won a championship, but, you know, just to play off, they're always in it. They're always doing something. And now they're this. And then at 12:30 a.m. on whatever day that was, yesterday or 2 days ago, Woj tweets out that they fired Igor Kokoschkov. Not out of nowhere, because there had been rumblings. Some of the rumblings were just, you just never know. Sarver could appoint one of the GOATs as coach. You just wouldn't, you put nothing past him. But there had been, I think, real rumblings. But it did feel like firing season had kind of passed and maybe Igor was going to survive. And then this happens. So what is your reaction?
I think a collective decision has been made by management and ownership. They are going to strip floor zero down to the studs. And I think, and this is just my personal theory, I think whether it is the coaching staff, whether it is the video room, the training staff might be overhauled for the first time in 15, 20 years.
I was going to say, that's a big one.
You know, and I think there is a sense that they just want to, and I'm not suggesting they should or shouldn't, but they're just going to defumigate the place. And they're just going to strip floor zero. And for those who know, floor zero is a very bifurcated structure in Phoenix, just architecturally, where the management is up on the fourth floor, and then down on floor zero, they call it, is the practice court, yeah, and the coaches' offices, and the training staff, and the video room, and sort of the basketball game night, player-focused world. And they're just – and this is part of that. I think one of the defining features, Zach, of distressed organizations is there's always a lot of good collateral damage. I mean, when I mean good, I mean good people who are collateral damage,
yeah,
right? Whether they're players who go on to play well elsewhere, whether management, you know, finds their way to an organization and wins championships, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Steve Kerr and Rick Welts, right? Like, a defining feature of distressed organizations is collateral damage, and Igor Kokoschkov is collateral damage. I think they might tell you that, you know, in terms of communication, it never really gelled with the young players, or maybe Igor was the right guy for a veteran-laden team, kind of a mix that they went into last season with playoff aspirations, but now they have this new project, and it's really focused on these 5-6 young guys, and well, they want a different voice, or all of a sudden sort of the Utah Jazz lineage might not be what's instilled. I don't know, and we'll learn more. I think James Jones is gonna, as we speak, I think is gonna it's a little earlier in Phoenix, but we'll speak in front of the media. He'll answer these questions.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that was gonna happen.
James, and by the way, James is very candid. I mean, that was one of the things, you know, when you spoke to him for the story.
Yeah.
I appreciate he is not a guy who will mince words, so I'm very curious to see. We'll know more, and actually listeners will have a better idea. But my sense is they are going to strip floor zero down to these studs. And that's what's going on here.
You know, we all get, like, there's all this outrage whenever a dumb team fires their coach.
There's just outrage in general right now.
Well, there's always outrage.
Yes.
But the knee jerk is, the Kings fired Dave Yeager. So here we go again. We saw this movie with Mike Malone. You taste success and you run away from it. There is something to be said for if, for whatever reason, you think that guy's not the guy for this roster, make a change. If the owner's willing to eat the money, make the change. You just better be sure and you better have a plan, because Dave Yeager's a good coach. Now, a whole other thing has happened that I don't feel qualified to address with the Kings right now because I haven't done a lot of reporting or research on it. Igor Kokoschkov is a good coach. So there does come a time where you just need to pick a coach, where you need to have it, where you need to value, like, maybe we think this guy's a B, but a B is good. A B is good. And if we just keep cycling through Bs every year, we're not going to get anywhere. So you better have a plan. And so it comes out that, you know, they're going to be candidates for Monty Williams. Okay. So my first thought was, why is Monty Williams going to take that job? What evidence is there that this is a good job? Devin Booker's good. Yeah, I think Devin Booker's good. Ayton's probably going to be all right. It's not going to pay a lot. It's one of the lowest paying head coaching positions in the league. And now I don't even know how many coaches they're paying now. So it's not like they are, you know.
I think it'll be Igor, and they also have Ryan McDonough. I don't know who else is on the. I think Earl might be off the books.
Earl might be off now?
I think now.
Okay.
Think.
Ryan is for sure on.
Yes, he is on.
So they're lighting. Multiple millions of dollars on fire still. Imani's obviously going to be a candidate for the Lakers job. Also, doesn't seem like a great job. I loved the Lakers fans' reaction yesterday to the report that Rob Pelinka and Kurt Rambis interviewed Jason Kidd. It was like a Mad Libs of just perfect ways to trigger all the Laker fans who are like, why is Kurt Rambis involved? What are we doing with Jason Kidd? What's happening to our franchise? So you fire Igor. You want to get Monty. If I'm Monty Williams, honestly, unless I love Devin Booker, unless I think this guy's a top eight player down the line, I'd rather just be the lead assistant for Philly again next year. The lead assistant. Go back to San Antonio. You know, say the Brett Brown thing doesn't work out and you don't get the Philly job or don't want the Philly job if Brett Brown gets fired. I just would bide my time before I took the Phoenix job.
Yeah, I never know. I mean, I always say this when GM candidates and coaching candidates are interviewing for what we think are undesirable jobs, and you get the same response I probably do. They're only 30. And actually, most of the good ones, by virtue of being good, don't open up very often.
For
right?
sure.
And so, okay. So I'll make the case for the Phoenix job for Monty. Okay.
Is this going to be the case for the Phoenix job or the case against the Lakers job? Because I almost want to hear the other one a bit more.
Oh, I think they're both fraught with all kinds of nonsense. But, okay, this is a team that, what, won 21 games, 20 games? I don't even remember what it was this season.
It was a low number.
But for the sixth straight season has been just awful. So, you know, and not that you ever want to take anything because it's a low bar, but wow, you look at the pieces. If I'm a basketball tactician and I believe in myself and my ability to inspire young players, boy, you know, Devin Booker, DeAndre Ayton, Bridges, like there's a lot of a top who it could be Zion, like, I mean, another top five guy. Like if I'm a sculptor, a potter looking for that's some nice clay. And okay, the owner is eccentric and a pain in the ass. Okay, I can deal with that because I'm Monty Williams, and in terms of sort of communication and dignity, like I can hold my own against anybody, and I can sell my vision, and I believe in my ability to sell that vision. And oh, by the way, like, that is talent. I'm going to win 34 games with that team, and that's going to be the most this franchise has won in 7 years. Devin is I've been looking for talents like Devin Booker's do not come along very often. And this is all attractive to me, and I can get James Jones to buy into what I want to do. He and I can break bread and share a vision, and
maybe we
I have confidence.
Maybe
in that.
We can team up and go 2-on-1 against Sarver.
Exactly.
Because you just said win 34 games, and the first thing I thought was I don't know that. I mean, this is the same team that tried to sign Tyson Chandler and LaMarcus Aldridge after accidentally winning a lot of games. The same team that signed Trevor Ariza for 1 year, $15 million. I don't know that, like, Robert Sarver might look at this team and say, we should be in the playoffs next year. We should be a 45-win team. 34 is not enough.
Right, and then you get the Dave Yeager treatment.
Yeah. 34 is not enough. We have Devin Booker. You just told me all these great players we have. Yeah. Why are we not in the playoffs?
Right. And then now you're making the argument. There are plenty of arguments against. I'm doing the intellectual exercise. At least they're trying to say, hey, if I'm Monty Williams, why do I want this job? I mean, there are worse places to live in Phoenix.
No, and
the
you
winter.
Get the pick is big because maybe you get Morant, who answers your point guard question. That's, you know, it's ridiculous that the team that had 9 point guards now has a point guard question, but yes. Here we are. And I am a Booker optimist. I think Devin Booker is really good, and there's a whole community of basketball fans who think Devin Booker is just totally bad and empty calories. I think Devin Booker is good. Ayton is going to be interesting. Now the wings to me are Jackson is getting pretty close to not quite sunk cost, but may have to go somewhere else.
I'm on the team Bridges on that. Yeah,
Bridges is solid, but
I really like Bridges.
He needs to be on a really good team because he's not going to take 12 shots a game. He's not going to. He just needs to be Danny Green. Oubre put up numbers there. I'm not sure how real.
I'm not an Oubre guy.
Yeah, I'm not sure how real those numbers were in terms of, you know, is any of that going to translate to a good team? So we'll see. We'll see how much they have. I don't want to talk about the Suns anymore. I don't want to talk about the Lakers. I just don't. I'm done with the Lakers. Any other playoff things you want to hit? Toronto, Philly, Boston, Milwaukee, Western Conference?
I'm just excited to stay in Toronto another few.
Like, I know you're moving in here.
Man, it's a great city. Zach, I mean, it is so cosmopolitan. The food is amazing. I got a running trail. Like, I like the people. It's efficient. It's clean. I take the train to the games. I stay up on Bloor Street. Like, so I'm doing the neighborhood thing. I think one of the problems sometimes in some of these cities is we all stay like downtown near the arena. And so I found a place that's like in a real neighborhood near the University of Toronto. Man, I even joined the gym for a month at the University of Toronto. I got back from Orlando, and after clearing customs, which is miserable at Pearson, I had this like feeling like, oh, I'm home. Like this is like relief at being back in Toronto. I'm very into this place.
How were the crowds in Orlando?
So I've noticed something about, everyone was like, oh, it was the loudest the arena's ever been. Here's the thing. These arenas are pumping in canned noise. And there were times where I couldn't hear myself think, and then I looked up because I'm down on the baseline, and what I see are very nice people in Orlando, nobody standing up and cheering and yelling. And I'm like, and I'm trying to actually now, I'm taking inventory of the noise I'm hearing, and I'm realizing it's all manufactured. The crowds were great. They were excited. These are basketball fans. Their team was in it. But it wasn't like, I mean, it's like, it was so loud. And it's like, no, this is what every arena in the league, with the exception of like four or five, are doing. They are just pumping. They are just turning up the amps to an unhealthy degree. And it gives the illusion of just the loudest the arena's ever been. And it's like, and I look around, there's like literally 18,000 people looking on their phones and eating and sipping their colas and like whatever the hell.
Cola? What are you, a grandma?
I'm a southerner. A cola.
Would you like a cola?
I'm from Atlanta, so it's always Coke and cola and soft drinks. It's never soda or pop.
It's not pop. I know. Midwest is pop. Yeah, I don't know. Everyone brags about their home crowd.
I am also 81 years old. You know that.
Yeah, the Brooklyn crowds were good, but they weren't as good as people said. They were good. They were good playoff crowds. Like, it's also only the first round. Like, the crowds should get better as the playoffs go because the stakes are higher. So we have Portland. Portland's done. And Toronto. I'll tell you, Toronto's been fun to watch. One of the reasons why is that Mark and Kyle, I think, sort of share some basketball DNA in terms of the way they can impact the game by taking like 12 combined shots. Like, they're just always doing stuff. They're always making a little extra pass, making a little extra cut. Showing up at a gig, Kyle gets a random offensive rebound at the end of game three that kind of seals the game. They're just always kind of doing stuff. Yeah.
I'm actually working on this, on Kyle, a feature on sort of the mystery of Kyle Lowry, which is even on a night when he's 0 for 7, he's like the only Raptor in positive plus minus and by an alarming degree.
That, what?
You know, it's the update the Michael Lewis story. I mean, I wouldn't say he's the no stats all-star because he's got plenty of stats. Yeah. He is an all-star. But there is, and this is one of the most consistent truths of the NBA, which is at the end of the season, you will look at the most advanced reliable metrics that gauge value while you're on the floor. And Kyle Lowry will be somewhere near the top, no matter how poor his shooting numbers were, or, oh, he wasn't feeling well this season, or, well, his production's from a raw perspective has fallen off. It doesn't matter. Kyle Lowry will be at the top. And he is helping you win basketball games, and I don't care if he's 2 for 9.
Well, he's just in constant motion, doing constantly good stuff. I mean, just useful stuff. Look at the way he rotates in and out. He's rotating, Tibbs talks about this all the time, he's rotating on the flight of the ball. He's not rotating late. He's rotating back out to his guy almost before the pass is thrown. He's setting little random screens everywhere. He's getting rebounds. He's tipping loose balls. And you sound nerdy talking about it because at the end of the day, you do need to score points. You need someone who can get you buckets at the end of a playoff game, which is what Kawhi Leonard is for them.
Yeah, and by the way, Pascal Siakam, they've got guys who can do that now. I mean, there's a lot of pressure taken off Kyle, and now he can kind of just be in his full Kyle-ness.
And it's been fun to watch, like, Marcus. So you know how many shots Marcus Gasol is averaging as a Raptor per game?
6 or 7.
5.8. He's just, like, not shooting at all. And he's having a massive impact on the game by making quick passes, by being in the right place at the right time on defense, by boxing out. And he and it's like Kyle has a guy now who's like him, because Ibaka's not like that. Ibaka's a good player. He's just not like that. Kawhi's not like that. Kawhi's an ISO scorer. He's a good passer, but he's a, like, I'm under the rim and I'm trapped passer. Yeah. And Danny Green's Danny Green doing whatever. Kyle and Mark, and you can see that they feel it like, oh, I've got a guy like me. He's going to give and go, and we're going to do this pick and roll thing. We're going to pass it back and forth like three times and cut over here. It's been kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying this team.
Mark is going to have to shoot, though, in this series. I told him that after the game. I was like, man, you're going to have to take some threes. You can't just not shoot, because that's like part of the reason you're here is because Embiid doesn't want to come out and guard you out there. You're going to have to actually shoot. And he's sort of laughing. You see, it's remarkable. He's taking six shots a game. He's taking Mikal Bridges-level shots per game.
That's funny.
It's so weird. Anyway, Kevin, thanks for your time. It's been an interesting, but all that not all that interesting first round, honestly. But the real games are going to start soon. I will see you somewhere, whether it's here or Philadelphia or wherever,
somewhere
in the near future.
In
somewhere.
The basketball universe, yes.
Thanks for and be on the lookout. So we got a Kyle feature coming. Anything else you want to talk about?
We're gonna have a fun thing with some of great Vince Carter conversation I had.
Ooh.
At some point. So we're working on that. My good man Austin Tedesco at ESPN and I are working on that.
Nice.
But and then I think some playoff fire alarm features. So we'll see. And just probably more Raptor stuff.
Yeah.
We'll be covering the Raps for the next week or so, at least.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks for the time and, we'll keep watching. It's going to be a fun second round. Kevin Arnitz, everybody.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.